Hey there, I hear it's your birthday. How old are you?
Well, I...
That's great. Would you like us to sing you a special song?
Hell no.
You got it. Ready, Senor Beaverati?
I'm a ready, and a one, and a two.
You're the birthday, you're the birthday, you're the birthday, boy or girl.
Tell the people what you hear.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble, trouble,
trouble. Radio basics.
And there's always a message involved.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. That's right. We are 1 year old. That's right, people. We made it. 1 year. This is the anniversary show. You know, over the past year, we've had some just amazing guests. Just, you know, just like the breadth of the knowledge that, you know, we've come in contact with is just unbelievable. And, you know, we're so grateful, and we compiled the best of show tonight of all the guests. I don't want to say best of because we couldn't get everyone in. We had, you know, over 40 guests. It's over 40 hours of material, and you know, we compiled it down, and we got some of the what we thought was the most enlightening stuff. So if you didn't make the show today, we're sorry, but thank you for coming on. You know, so we're going to go back. It's 1 year ago. You know, this is, we had on our first show, investigative journalist Kevin Pina, expert on Haiti. He was interviewed by our own Kabir. This is September 11th, 2008. Like I said, an investigative journalist who'd been living and working in Haiti for 2 decades, who has repeatedly thrown himself in harm's way when it comes to exposing the truth of foreign imperialist domination in Haiti. He's been a tireless advocate of the liberation struggles of Haiti. Here he is, Kevin Pina.
Which began with the Martin administration, they have a direct responsibility in having destroyed Haiti's institutions by backing a paramilitary coup, by backing a false opposition movement that overthrew the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February 2004. Mm-hmm. And Haiti's institutions were destroyed, and they have never recovered since. So they have, in that sense, they have a direct responsibility for those deaths on the ground. It is criminal that given the experience of Hurricane Jeanne and Gonaive in 2004, that there were not plans to evacuate only 160,000 residents in Gonaive. The Cubans managed to evacuate more than 800,000 people in Havana within a matter of 6 hours, 7 hours. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with this picture?
That was Kevin Pina. You know, that was one of the first shows that we did here on Radio Basics. And yeah, Kevin, you know, he's an expert on Haiti. And he, in that little clip, you know, he really summed up some of the struggles going on there. And if you want to check out any of these old shows, hit up www.radioforall.net, and then in the little search box, Radio Basics, and we've got all of our shows listed from the past year. In the next piece, a guest host of Radio Basics, Nadine El Kassem, interviews Fred Hampton Jr. Now, if anyone is familiar with the Black Panther Party, just a legendary revolutionary organizing group that started in Oakland in the United States and bloomed into one of the biggest movements that was horribly, horribly repressed by the state. And, you know, if you really want to understand just the viciousness that can come to people organizing in the community, like, you should check out not only what happened to the Black Panthers, but Fred Hampton, who, you know, was murdered in cold blood in his sleep. And it's not even a secret anymore. It's just, you know, killed with impunity. So this is Fred Hampton Jr. of the Prisoners of Conscience Committee, a revolutionary prisoner's justice and people's organization in the United States. Here he is, Fred Hampton Jr.
So I'd like to welcome Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. to Radio Basics. Welcome, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr.
Revolutionary appreciation for having me on. Tenth-fifth salute to you as well as to the listeners.
Thanks so much. So first I wanted to ask you just your general thoughts on Barack Hussein Obama's win, what you think about it.
Because my father, Chairman Fred, used to say, you know, nothing is all good, ain't nothing all bad. So it's some contradictions that, you know, that we can see at the time to, you know, to expose different issues in the community. I'm saying it's not a number of importance, but just a few things that come to my mind. One is this class contradiction. A lot of people talking about this attempt to put black people as a whole, it's just some monolithic, you know, one piece. But the reality is, a lot of people say, well, man, they talk about forces such as Barack, you know, the primitive petty bourgeoisie. It's something that we have to deal with, you know what I'm saying, and whenever we talk about the discussion of struggle, and that is a class contradiction. Mm-hmm. And also, a lot of people say, you know, would he be good for America? And that may be the case, because America itself has, just even with the discussion of a Barack Obama running, American government has benefited in a number of ways, one being just the image, the facade, the front. Because as Malcolm X stated, that America's democracy is an hypocrisy. And under the regime of George W. Bush, it got to the point that the whole world it became very clear what was going down inside America. So this whole facade, this front, with Barack Obama running, and now being a president-elect or elect, whatever the case, you know, time will tell, we really went down. It serves this interest again to put forward this front that, and it also sets back a conscience that had got to the point in the last 2004 election, the American populace, that became very clear that America itself doesn't even have free elections. You know, people that became very clear about such issues, such contradictions as the Electoral College and other contradictions that America goes around the world and, you know, challenges China and Iraq and other places, saying that they don't have free elections, something that America itself doesn't even have. But just with this whole discussion about Barack Obama, it is got the people again, you know, saying to fall prey into this whole facade, chasing this American dream. Back to their class issue. The reality is us, the people that I represent, the masses down here in the valley, not the mountaintop, down here in the valley. Mm-hmm. We still dealing with, you know what I'm saying, rough and tough issues, you know what I'm saying? People talking about this whole, about the economic recession. Shit, we go through this every day, you know what I'm saying? We on a day-to-day basis, we dealing with cases of political prisoners every day, cases of police terrorism every day. And people say, would America benefit? We say America itself might benefit, but what's good for the hunter is not good for the hunted. And we don't say the victims of America, we still going through war conditions on a day-to-day basis.
That was Fred Hampton Jr. Fred Hampton Jr. was interviewed by guest interview Nadeem Elkassem of Basics Free Community Newsletter, our newsletter that, you know, comes out, and we just have our new issue out, and you can check it out. Hit up basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com, and you know, that's the newsletter. And also we have a website, basicsnews.ca, that's, you know, coming up, and I saw the website today. It is a fantastic website, so, you know, good work, Basics. So, like I said, Fred Hampton Jr., and, you know, over the course of the show, like, we've come in contact with just, you know, it's almost humbling, like, how amazing some of these people are, and, you know, just to be talking to Fred Hampton Jr., and you know, part of the legacy of Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers is just, you know, a truly, truly humbling experience, and absolutely enlightening, too. So before we go to break, we're going to play a clip. This was Familia Negra with Barrio Nuevo, an organizing group in Toronto, and Radio Basics. This was live in the studio, CHRY. Familia Negra is, you know, a revolutionary black consciousness group from Venezuela. They were in Canada as part of the Frente Norman Bethune International Organizers Brigade, organized by Barrio Nuevo here in Toronto, a Latino Canadian group, like I said. They're spreading the word in Canada about the Bolivarian struggle for socialism down in Venezuela. In addition to talking about some of their observations in regard to the October 2008 election, they freestyled for us in the studio, and we're gonna let this song take us to commercial. So this is Familia Negra on Basics Radio on the anniversary show, CHRY 105.5.
Back, CHRY 105.5, Radio Basics. It is Waves You Crave Week here at CHRY, and we're looking for donations from our supporters, from our listeners. CHRY 105.5 is a listener-driven community campus radio station, and we cannot survive without the support of the people. So, you know, like our Venezuelan comrades here tonight have been telling us about the revolution in Venezuela, the people uniting, coming together to make change happen. This is what we got to keep doing here in Canada as well if we're going to make a difference. So please call in. The number is 416-736-5656. Call in, make a pledge to Radio Basics. It'd be much appreciated, and keep this work going. Now, we're coming back with Familia Negra. We got Aja, and we got Ricardo Scott. And we're going to be doing a little freestyle. And Pablo's going to be doing a little translation for me. So, actually, no, we don't need that. We're just going to go straight into freestyle.
Straight into freestyle, man. These guys know what they're doing.
Oh,
see.
All right, man.
Sabe que
si. Let's drop it. Let's drop it.
Okay. ¿Cómo está Canadá? Toronto, Caracas, Venezuela, presente. Yo, my family association for America Latino. I speak a little. Tú sabes cómo es eso, you know?
Con el respeto de todos los presentes, incursiona acá un soldado negro. Hip hopper cimarrón que representa la familia negra del Cumbe, Quilombo, Gueto, de la Vega, autóctono. Crecimiento progresivo para el ser humano. Enlaces del pasado, presente, futuro. Tesoro cultural del afroamericano. La misión, difundir la riqueza cultural del pueblo venezolano a través de la folclórica historia de nuestros antepasados. Siempre presente el principio de romper cadenas ideológicas de esclavitud. Este soldado negro de libre pensamiento abraza el sentimiento de unidad entre los pueblos latinoamericanos. Maestro de ceremonia cuando cantas impresiona. Tu público te aplaude cuando cantas en su zona. No le tira a nadie ni tampoco jala. Para que te suenen en la radio por payola.
MC on the ground, master cultura cimarrón, verdadero de alma pura. Damn, aflójeme la cuerda que voy con soltura. Tengo más letra que un libro, lo demuestra mi escritura. Caballo estoy presente hoy en día, luchando y combatiendo con la fucking hegemonía. Dime, verdadero rap no vive en fantasía. Dime, verdadero rap no canta hipocresía. No, solo el legado, una real.
Sponsored event.
Estás escuchando CHRY 105.5, tu estación de radio comunitaria. Escucha en vivo en nuestro sitio web www.chry.fm.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. We're back on the one-year anniversary show. Sorry about the delay in the last part. The commercial was in Spanish. I didn't realize it was a segue back into... putting me back on the air. So sorry about that. Sorry about the delay. And we're back with the anniversary show. So, you know, over the course of the year, there's been some economic turbulence, to say the least, insofar as, you know, the complete collapse of the financial industry that was only brought back to life. The corpse was actually brought, revived, resurrected through the massive transfer of, you know, taxpayer dollars, our dollars, to the financial class of society. And what that's going to spell out in the future for workers and for unions is, you know, obviously cuts to social programs, higher taxes, and the like. And so we did a series of shows called Unionism and the Fate of the Ontario Working Class in response to, you know, the strikes, the QP strike, what was happening in the auto industry with workers. So this is Radio Basics own Steve DeSilva, you know, giving some context to this. And then we're going to play, you know, the series of the four guests that we had on. So this is Steve DeSilva speaking about the bailouts.
In national news, the Canadian government's bailout to the banks has now reached a staggering $275 billion. Last week, on January 27th, the Conservative government released its long-awaited 2009 federal budget report, which projects an $85 billion deficit spending over the next 4 to 5 years. While all of the public debate that was centered around the issue was about how much money should be spent on stimulating the economy. Should it be this much or should it be that much? How much money should we go into deficit to try to pull Canadians out of this crisis and the Canadian economy out of this crisis? That was essentially the debate around which the terms of the debate over the government budget. But virtually no media coverage was given to the fact that in the budget, provision has been made for a $200 billion bailout for Canada's charter banks. This program, going under the name of the Extraordinary Financing Framework, is intended to provide the banks with liquid assets, or cash, basically, by buying up assets that the banks hold. Now, let's step back to late 2008 in the United States, where the U.S. government, from Bush to Obama, was bailing out banks and financial institutions to the tune of trillions of dollars, buying up junk assets, worthless assets from these financial institutions to keep them afloat at the expense of regular American people, regular taxpayers. What has been called cash for trash. The same thing is now happening in Canada. The Canadian government, through the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation and through the Treasury, is going to be buying up massive amounts of these assets from Canadian banks, which in the economic climate we're in, with more and more Canadians losing their jobs, not being able to access unemployment insurance, welfare benefits, are going to default en masse on a lot of their credit liabilities and their debts. And now the Canadian public as a whole is being made to pay for the irresponsible financial practices of these institutions and organizations, the banks. So while so much debate was centered around the nature of this deficit and should we be giving this much billion or that much billion to create jobs and to put our kids in school and to put money into healthcare to stimulate the economy, while all of this debate was focused around that, no debate whatsoever was had around the fact that a blank check for $200 billion has essentially been signed for the banks. This is going to have massive, massive repercussions in terms of a staggering public debt in the near future, which is going to be used as a justification to continue slashing programs, community programs, healthcare, subsidization of public education, our public school system, and so on and so forth. So if people didn't know, and I would be surprised if you've actually heard about this before, because the corporate media has been absolutely silent on this issue. If you want to learn more, check out our website. We just updated our analysis on the website, basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com, talking about the economic crisis and what's being done behind closed doors to help the banks at the expense of Canadian people. Check it out. This is need to know information.
That was Radio Basics' own Steve DeSilva spelling out the ramifications for working people about what these bailouts truly meant. Now, the first in the string of, rollbacks was obviously the auto workers who came under intense heat when you had the collapse of the big three North American car companies, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Now, while these car companies were bailed out, unfortunately, it spelled, mass layoffs for most of the employees and really unionism. Workers coming together and having a democratic input in the process of decision making, that really come under fire from corporate media because it didn't allow them to put through their agenda of, restructuring, layoffs, rolling back pensions, just creating massive insecurity amongst the working class. So this was part one. We had CAW, the economist from the CAW, Jim Stanford, come on the phone and just, explain why unionism is still an important thing in society.
I'm giving up your appeal. You should have been able to.
But I'd be glad to.
Okay, Jim, so let's start. Why unions? Why in particular the CAW?
Well, why unions is an easy one to answer, Jason. Here's how work
is organized in our economy, which in my book I call capitalism. You don't hear that word very often, capitalism. I sometimes call it the C word. Mentioning the word capitalism makes you sound like some kind of raving Bolshevik, right?
That's true.
But the reality is that's the system we have. 85% of the GDP in our economy is produced by private companies who are in it to make a private profit. And the work that is done in those companies is done in the form of what's called wage labor, where the employers hire someone for a certain wage to come in and do that work in return for a wage or salary. And then the company tries to sell the output for a profit. Now, in that relationship, that employment relationship, it's never a level playing field. The worker always needs the job more than the employer needs the worker. For any individual worker, that's always the case, because the worker needs a job to pay the bills and put food on the table. The employer needs any particular worker to do some work, but if they lose that worker, they can almost always go out and find someone else, unless the person has a very, very unique skill or something like that. So it's not a level playing field. The individual worker needs the job much more than the employer needs them, and that allows the employer to basically put the screws to the worker and try and maximize the output, maximize the work effort, and minimize the compensation. Now, a way to level the playing field is for all the workers to basically band together and try to deal with the employer as one. And that's what's called collective bargaining. If you do that, then you level the playing field a bit, because then the workers still need the job, but now the employer isn't looking at any one particular worker who's generally disposable. Now the employer is looking at the whole lot of them, the whole collective of workers, and should they decide to stop working or carry on some kind of campaign or a strike or whatever, the employer faces a genuine problem. So with collective bargaining, by forming a union and then approaching the employer as one to deal with the employer on wages and working conditions, the workers can get a lot better value from the employer, get a much better share of the wealth that they create. So that idea has motivated workers for hundreds of years to organize unions, sometimes against the most incredible odds. You know, there are times, even today in the world, where you can be killed for trying to organize a union. Mm-hmm. And even in Canada, you can get fired for trying to organize a union, yet workers still do it. And it's because they generally understand at their gut level that they won't get a fair deal just going one-on-one to the employer and asking for a better deal. They have to join with their colleagues. Now, in terms of the CAW, I think the CAW has got a great record in a range of industries, not just auto. Only about 10% of our members today work in the auto industry, in all kinds of industries, and showing that by organizing people, being ambitious.
Okay, so I'm going to pretend to be a National Post reporter right now, working for that rag of a newspaper.
Okay.
And I'm going to sort of repeat what is so-called popular opinion out there. One being that unions were once necessary, but not anymore.
You know, it's funny to hear that quote, because I can tell you that people said that quote in the 1700s. You know, there were unions that were formed in the 1600s, and anti-union people in the 1700s said, oh, well, times were tough in the 1600s. Maybe you needed a union then, but we don't need them now. Mm-hmm. And same was true in the 1800s and 1900s. I've got a great quote from the guy, I forget his name, he was the right-wing premier of Ontario during the Depression, and he was very anti-union, and he had said exactly the same thing in the Great Depression. Well, maybe unions were necessary in the 1870s, but they're not necessary today. Unions will always be necessary, because that fundamental power imbalance between workers who need a job, each individual worker needs a job to put food on the table, but to an employer, any individual worker is dispensable. They can always be replaced. And the only way to even that power situation is for the workers to get together and have a collective voice, a common voice. Mm-hmm. So we have seen unions, we've seen unions lose some of their power in Canada. A little under 30% of workers.
That was CW economist Jim Stanford. I interviewed him like right in the wake of the bailouts to the auto industry, and he really spelled out what it meant for workers and why they still need to organize. the second part of that series, we had Sam Gindin. Sam used to be, you know, a researcher at the CAW, and he was within the union for a long time. And again, he kind of reiterates some of the same points and builds on it. So this is Sam Gindin.
As a human being, of it. The other dimension is just the nature of what being a worker is under capitalism. And one of the points about capitalism is its relationship to democracy. But the thing about capitalism is that some people sell their labor power because they have to survive to other people who control it. And it's a very fundamentally undemocratic relationship, that somebody is controlling your capacity as a human being and also how your capacity as a human being develops. Now, if we take democracy seriously, then we have to start talking about changing that relationship, that democracy isn't just about a form of government, but democracy is actually about a form of society where people can control their capacities collectively, and that means taking on corporate power. So that's why workers are so central, because at the heart of the relationship of workers to their employers and workers under capitalism is this undemocratic question about people's potentials and who controls them. And that lack of democracy affects everything in society. I mean, if you can't control investment and therefore who has jobs and what kind of jobs and how you relate at work, then you really can't control your life. So I think the working class stands for that issue of democratic control over our capacities and therefore over administering our lives in a democratic way. And, you know, it's because workers are so central to that question, have our position strategically within capitalism in terms of being able to stop production, and have resources because they've actually organized collectively in workplaces rather than be fragmented all over the place, that workers have historically become, ended up in the center of this question of changing society. Now, I think what that means is that it doesn't inevitably mean that workers will be radical, obviously. And it doesn't mean that if radical change were to emerge, that it would necessarily start with the unionized working class. It might start someplace else. But I don't think it could be sustained unless you got workers involved in this. I think that's absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Sam, I know you've put forward... you put forward ideas in building a more broader movement, but you've also discussed some, you know, concrete alternatives to globalization. You've talked about transforming excess capacity. Uh-huh. Could you just build on that?
Yeah, let me say something about that, and then I just want to link that back to what we've just been talking about. I mean, one of the questions is, here are the auto workers. The auto industry is in crisis. Society, the whole economy is in crisis globally. And they're being squeezed to give up things that they've won, you know, for over the last 70 years, seven decades, and they're being squeezed. And they're being not just squeezed in terms of giving up, but they're also being, you know, coming out of this as a demoralization about what's possible, an attempt to lower expectations, and to just be satisfied with whatever you can scrape through because you got to survive. So the question is, what could auto workers possibly do about this? You know, what are you going to do, go on strike? Well, that's not helpful when nobody wants your work. And I think that the only way this could have been dealt with is if people stopped thinking about how do we save the companies and started thinking in terms of how do we save the productive capacity in the community. That what's going on is we actually have this productive capacity that the companies don't want, you know, for producing auto parts, for example, but include... crucial equipment, tool and die, machinery, molding equipment that could be used to make almost anything. And the question is, when they close these plants and say, we don't want them, why don't we say we should expropriate them and start thinking about converting them under some kind of a plan? Now, that would necessitate having some plan for conversion and where you're going and what the demands would be. And an obvious one is the environment, because everything, you know, through this next century, everything about how we live, produce, consume, travel is going to be changed, what homes are going to be like, what factories are going to be like, what infrastructure is going to be like. Well, why don't we get ready for that? And I think that, you know, that does a number of things. It means you stop thinking in terms of my loyalty is with my company because it's my job. You start thinking about a social use and where you fit in socially. It also means you stop thinking about how do I become competitive and lower my costs so I can be competitive, and you start thinking about planning. That's the way we have to think about it if we're going to have security. You stop defending the companies for making the cars they're making and start thinking about, well, what else can we be doing socially? You don't just represent the workers who are working, but you start thinking about the workers who have been laid off, whose numbers are greater than the ones still working. So you start changing all of that. Now, to do this, you know, we don't have the power to do this. It's just an idea. But it means that people can start thinking differently. It means that workers, when a company is running down the equipment, might say, I want to take it over before they run it all down so we can put it under the structure and start converting it. It gives them some initiative that they can take instead of just watching and waiting. And then it raises the question, well, how do you have the political capacity to do this? Because there's no way the Harper government is going to do this, and in fact, the NDP wouldn't do it either. So that means you have to start thinking about, well, how do we deal with this in terms of political capacities? And by political capacities, I mean starting to develop amongst workers a general understanding of what's going on, an understanding of the direction we're going in isn't going to solve our problems. How do you actually make links with others? How do you create new structures through which you can fight back? You take seriously what you're up against. Capitalism is incredibly powerful. And if we want to change things, it's not about listing a whole bunch of good things that we'd like. It's about actually saying, well, how do we do this? And how do we do this collectively? And where does our strength lie? So it requires addressing all those questions. And I think that's what's lacking. And the question is whether through this crisis, people are going to start asking those kinds of questions and taking that kind of perspective, and whether we actually might see something more radical start emerging.
That was Sam Gindin, you know, former member of the CAW and current Packer chair of social justice at York University. He was part two in Unionism and the Fate of the Ontario Working Class. For part three, we had Stephanie Ross, and actually Stephanie Ross was one of our most successful shows in terms of downloads, like After, which you can find at www.radioforall.net. Search Radio Basics. This is Stephanie Ross, and she, you know, has a lot of experience with QP, and, you know, when the garbage workers were on strike and taking a ton of heat, Stephanie came in and, you know, kind of spelt out and highlighted their side of the story.
They tell you to take pride in your job, but then, you know, they shame people for having a good job with, you know, some sort of benefits and security for when they retire.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's only one thing to call it, which is, you know, that we're in a period of not only hypocrisy, I guess it's fair to say, but lowering expectations, right? That we are being always and every day encouraged to lower our expectations as workers, as citizens, when it comes to things that make for a good quality of life for us, right? So I think what you say is really interesting. You know, when it comes to, you know, working hard and providing the employer with the value of your labor, then you should take pride in work, right? Because it's going to make you productive.
Right.
But when it comes to protecting the quality of work for oneself and one's coworkers, that is somehow selfish, right? It's as if to say, protecting good quality jobs in the local economy doesn't have a broader positive impact, which all of the research on unionization rates shows that it does, right? The higher the rate of unionization and the higher the capacity of unionized workers to sort of set the pace of wages and benefits and so forth, the better the spin-off effect is for the rest of the economy, because non-union employers, you know, don't want to risk unionization, right? So they have to kind of keep pace at least a little bit if they want to, you know, prevent people's discontent from turning into unionization, right? So, you know, in that sense, you're right. We are living in a topsy-turvy period when, you know, what's good for the goose is not good for the gander, right?
No, true. Okay, so let's talk about unions more generally. Many, like Judith Andrews, spokeswoman for Canadian Federation of Small Businesses,
says unions aren't useful anymore and it's too antagonistic for working people than it is helpful. Is this so?
Well, in I guess it depends on who you know whose interests are being thought of in this statement, right? Mm-hmm. Certainly for small business, it might be the case that unions are a problem, right? Yeah. But, you know, in terms of understanding the value that unions have, it's the easiest thing to do is to look at the situation of workers who don't have unions. Mm-hmm. And in general, most people who don't have unions are much more at risk of having their basic employment standards rights violated. And the Toronto Workers Action Center has documented very effectively the widespread violation of sort of basic employment standards like minimum wages, payment of vacation pay and stat holiday pay, or even to pay workers at all. I mean, the amount of businesses in Toronto who fail to pay their employees for work that they've done is really quite shocking.
Mm-hmm. That was Stephanie Ross. Like I said, Stephanie was a great guest. She was one of our most successful shows in terms of downloaded afterwards when we post them on the internet. So part four was Greg Albo, a university professor at York University, and he kind of spelt out what the bailouts will mean for working people and what it's going to translate into in the future.
The question then is, who's going to pay for this? Capitalism partly pays for these things through an economic crisis and high rates of unemployment, the destruction of capital, and so on. Part of the strategy so far has been to avoid that destruction of capital and try to engineer it through the state taking on the debt or socializing the debt and providing subsidies back to the banks or to the auto sector. The auto sector is in the public sector right now, but will slowly be returned to the private sector. And so that what's happening is the debts are being socialized, and the companies are slowly going to be made profitable again, and then the profits are going to return to the capitalists who come back to own these enterprises. Now, workers then are in fact paying for this crisis in two ways. We're going to pay for it, or they're attempting to make us pay for it through taxes, because they socialize the debt inside the state. They'll make us pay for it through the reduction of services. They'll just provide less public services, less quality education, less quality parks, and so forth. And they're having workers pay for it through the demands of a lot of concessions and rolling back pensions, wages, workplace benefits, and so on. So they're having workers pay for it in a number of ways. Now, why then are workers not able to, and the social movement's not being able to fight back? And that is the major political question of the moment. And I think that has a lot to do with the way neoliberalism through the last two decades has managed to
couldn't have had more than five drinks.
I couldn't have had
more than three or four.
Six drinks?
Probably about
I was fine till the shots kicked in.
So now I'm missing three teeth.
My boyfriend thinks I'm a skank.
My girlfriend won't talk to me.
I ended up with a broken nose.
But now I've got gonorrhea.
My best friend thinks I'm a slut.
And everybody knows.
People are talking about it.
I can't remember a damn thing, but
my parents know.
If you're going to drink.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. We're back with the anniversary edition. It's our 1 year birthday. We're 1 year old and we made it. And, thanks for listening and thanks for tuning in every week. And I actually got a little birthday present today. Alex.
Hi, buddy.
Alex is here in the studio. Alex has been on the show once, maybe twice, maybe
three times. A few times, yeah. But you can count them on your hand.
That's right. But hopefully many, many more in the near future. Alex is part of Basics and, is always out in the community. So look out for her. She's a great person. So there you go. So you want to introduce
I'm going to introduce the next clip. So the next clip is a short excerpt of an interview conducted by Steve De Silva of Radio Basics with the legendary revolutionary hero of the Philippines, Jose Maria Sison, or JOMA, also the current chairperson of the International League of People's Struggles. So Steve caught up with JOMA at the international headquarters of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines in Utrecht, Netherlands, this past summer, 2009. Queuing it up right now.
JOMA, the people of Canada, of various nationalities, and of course, all the indigenous peoples, to fight against imperialist globalization. They can play a very important role because right they are in the country right beside the big monster, the United States of America, and of course the ruling class of Canada and that of the United States of America are closely interlinked. They collaborate to oppress and exploit the people both in Canada and elsewhere in the world. So I would wish that organizations that are progressive work hard and try to achieve more success in arousing, organizing, and mobilizing the people of Canada of various nationalities and ethnicities against monopoly capitalism and for democracy and socialism.
Well, JOMA, thank you very much for meeting with Basics and Radio Basics.
Thank you, too.
That was Jose Marie Sison, chairperson of the International League of People Struggles, revolutionary hero of the Philippines. And, you know, Steve caught up with him in the Netherlands, lucky Steve. And, you know, these last sets of interviews are probably our, like, some of the biggest that we did. You know, it's just meeting these people, like, Jose Maria Sison, he's, you know, known all throughout the world and in tons of, you know, so-called third world countries. So our next guest, he was probably featured on our most downloaded show, which is 340 and counting. This is Dr. Michael Parenti. He's written countless books and, you know, vicious critic of United States imperialism, and it was such a pleasure to have this guy on. So this is a clip of Dr. Michael Parenti.
System.
Maybe I should give a little context to this clip, actually. We interviewed him in regards to Canada building a monument to memorialize the 100 million who have allegedly died under communist rule. Parenti, you know, disputes the claim, to say the least, and explains maybe there's another system out there that killing way more people. That's right, Alex. Sorry, I didn't have your microphone on.
I just said killing more people.
Yes, and you know, he'll explain it. So here is Dr. Parenti.
And a study was done by Arch Getty and two Russian historians, not Soviet, but Russian. This is afterwards. And they went through every record and counted every name, every victim. And it came to quite a number, something like upwards of 680,000, close to 700,000, if you add people who never made it in the record or whatever, or identities weren't quite known or something.
So just to be clear,
the reason I tried to look at that is because that was the first evidence I ever saw. All I ever heard were people saying that the victims of the gulag were 5 million, 7 million, 12 million, 20 million, 30 million, and nobody presenting anything that resembled what could be called data. But when you have such a wide variance of numbers of victims, you know that people are just pulling numbers out of their head, out of their hat, and out of their head. So this was what we saw. And what Getty and his two associates found was there's about, as I say, upwards of 700,000 people who died in the gulag. But that included a lot of non-political prisoners. It included people who just died, worked and dropped dead in and such. That didn't mean all those people were executed. But some were executed. Some of them were executed for political crimes under Stalin during the purges, and some were executed for just the regular civil society crimes like murder, rape, major embezzlement, or whatever else. Mm-hmm. So that's the number we come up with. How these people got this 100 million, I don't know, it's a very nice rounded number. And if you say it, you keep repeating it often enough, then that becomes the number. What they should really do is build a much larger monument for the victims of colonialism, capitalist imperialism, and such. Because that's where you can really see the victims. I mean, the number of people killed in Uganda, the number of people killed in Angola just 20 years ago, estimated at 2 million right there, just in Angola. The number of people killed in North Korea, the North Koreans during the American attacks on North Korea of 1950 to 53, they estimate upwards of 2 million. Just about every building in their country was bombed and hit. The entire infrastructure was destroyed. They're still trying to recover from the effects of some of that. The massacres that took place, U.S. troops in Korea, there are descriptions of it that we never hear about here in the West. And the massacres, for instance, that the capitalist interest did all through Africa. There's no communists who went into Africa and killed as many people as that. The German imperialists and investors who went into Southwest Africa and the Herero tribe of 80,000, they killed about 60,000 of the 80,000. And then they enslaved the other 20,000 to work on the railroads and the mines. The million or more that King Leopold of Belgium killed in the Congo, one could go on. There are no communist countries that did that. There's no communist countries that went into India and killed and murdered large numbers of people. There were no communist countries that came across North America and wiped out about a million Native American First Nation people in Canada and in what is now the United States, all these different Indian nations. So if you really want to start counting, I think you'd have to count. And then what the Nazis did in World War II, perpetrated a war which resulted in the death of about 40 million people. You could easily get to 100 million without stretching it, where I don't think you could get to that number with the communists.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. That was Dr. Michael Parenti, and he was probably... He definitely was our most downloaded show, and Parenti is known all over the world. He's wrote countless books that he used in university courses, and generally just like really interesting, and I suggest if you never heard of him, get to know him. Okay, so our show's winding down, our anniversary show. I was lucky enough to have Alex kind of stroll in a little late, but thanks for showing up, Alex.
I'm sorry, everybody.
That's okay. They forgive me. So, I was going to end this show. I did a show a few weeks ago. I interviewed this, he was a UN observer to an international criminal case. Just recently they released a Libyan out of a Scottish prison, and, it made big headlines in the United States. He apparently blew up an airplane back in the 80s, and they convicted him. It was a very, very controversial case, and so I interviewed the UN observer to this case. He's a famous, he has a society named after him. It's a Hans Kochler Society, and he's really famous, and it was probably personally one of my favorite interviews, and so here's a short clip of that. This is Dr. Hans Kochler.
They needed a scapegoat, and the Scottish churches were too afraid to come up with the decent and fair decision, which would have been not proven. That is what I expected after what we had been shown. Mm-hmm. Not proven in the case of both.
Mm-hmm.
so many uncertainties, ambiguities, so much was just based on hearsay and so on.
Mm-hmm, which led you to say that the verdict was arbitrary and irrational.
Yes, of course, and I also told myself if a student would have presented such an argument of the in the way these judges had drafted their opinion of the court, I would have this student would have failed. I would not have accepted that. Would not have accepted that paper.
That was Dr. Hans Kochler. I mean, to discuss the intricacies of that case, it took an entire show, and it's still, you know, there's a lot to be said. But right now, there's, you know, a lot of talk about the politics behind it. And again, www.radioforall.net. Search Radio Basics in that little search box, and you'll get all the greatest hits of Radio Basics, because every show is really a gem. So, you know, our show is winding down. You know what, I just am like really appreciative of all the guests and all the people that came on, so you know, I'm going to try and name you all, and if I miss you, I'm sorry, but here we go.
But first you have to say thank you to the hosts of Radio Basics who have been coming through for this past year.
Hosts are, of course, Alex, who's been on, you know, a handful.
But
our sister Micaiah, who's out in the United States in New York City, you know, it's gonna take the music industry by storm any day. Corey, you know, hosted a good amount of shows and was, you know, instrumental in getting the show off the ground. David Chin, probably the funniest man in the whole world.
Radio history.
In the history of radio. Our good buddy Kabir. Kabir does a ton of shows. This guy is well known by, you know, tons of people, and thank you, Kabir. Steven. Steve DeSilva, we featured on a few clips. He was, you know, instrumental in getting the show off the ground. CHRY, you know, the best damn radio station in the continent, for having us. You know, it's a community radio and public radio funded by everybody. And thanks for listening. Thanks for having us, of course. And so, you know, I want to run down a list of guests, and if you're not on here and you're listening, thank you. So, Chris Bolton, Kevin Pina, Fred Hampton Jr., Will Prosper, Arnold Otaru, Karen Hayes, Tyler Shipley, Nick Redman, Adam Hanaya, Honor Ford Smith, Dudley Laws, Chris Wasson, Norman Otis Richmond, Sam Ginden, Jim Stanford, Greg Albo, Stephanie Ross, Mark Harold, Hans Kochler, Hugh Miles, Michael Parenti, Jose Marie Sisson, Efren Perez Jr., Abayomi Ezekiwe, Justice for Awi, Alok Premji, Barry Nuevo, and everybody else that I didn't get, or I might have skipped over your name. Thank you for being a part of Radio Basics, helping the show on for a year, and you know, for hopefully for many, many, many more. So we're gonna play a track here, you know, one dedicated to all those people I just named.
Yes. Happy New Year, Radio Basics.
Yes, happy New Year, Radio Basics. Thanks for listening. CHRY 105.5.
Out of tune, would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends. And what do I do when my love is away? Does it worry you to be alone? Be alone. How do I feel by the end of the day? Are you sad because you're on your own? Well, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Wanna try with a little help from my friends. Do you need anybody? Somebody to love. Could it be?
turn on the light. I can't tell you, but I know it's mine. Oh, I can buy with a little help from my friend. I get high with a little help from my friend. Need somebody to
need
love
somebody.
Could it be I get